from cosmology, and then got interested in quantum gravity, and now does quantum cosmology. And this is one person pushing to extend the viability of loop cosmology by really using HPC techniques, and he will tell us about that now. Thank you.
Thank you, Bianca.
And Param, sorry. He's now even tenured and a state employee of at Louisiana State University.
Well, I have to disappoint Bianca a little bit because I'm not going to talk anything about HPC in this talk except few words, because like there is not sufficient time. There are a lot of techniques which go into developing numerical methods in loop quantum cosmology. So my goal will be to give an introduction to the main subject, because most of us here may not be aware of that. Give some very basic numerical tools which you can employ for understanding the what actually can go wrong and what viable lessons we can extract from this approach, and then to use that approach to push the boundaries of what we already know. So first of all, I'd like to start with thanks to organizers, to Bianca and Renate and PI for organizing this wonderful school, to my funding agencies, which have been very generous, NSF, John Templeton Foundation, and Extreme Science and Engineering Discovery Environment, which gives me HPC grants, and lots of colleagues, and I've learned a lot from them. Tomasz Pawlowski, my long-term friend and collaborator, who is one of the founding fathers of this area, Daniel Cartin and Gaurav Khanna, who have tremendously contributed to understand von Neumann stability issues, which I'll be talking about a lot today. Mary Sekelardo, who is supposed to show up, she's late, and Peter Diener, my present collaborator at LSU, and we both work on HPC techniques. And my grad students and postdocs, unfortunately, they did their work and they disappeared, so the attrition rate is high in this subject, so eventually I have to work with the senior collaborators and the numerical relativity community, Eric Schnetter, for example, here, who have developed a beautiful framework called CACTUS, which was mentioned in Sumati's talk also, and which we use now, this approach to develop HPC tools. Some of the reviews, I will be sending these slides and then you can look at some of these papers. There are two reviews on numerical loop quantum cosmology, which are quite useful. They are both complementary to each other. Most of the things I'll be talking in the talk today will be in my review here, and many new things will be in these papers which have appeared, and some very beautiful works also by Mary and Martin Boyewald, Daniel Cartin, Gaurav Khanna. And also, if you want to look at very early papers, 11-year-old papers on the first results on quantum bounds, on which this talk will be focused on, these are the papers on which there were both analytical issues and numerical issues. And now, since Mary is here, I should remind that she played a very important role. So I've already thanked her in my slides. So, okay, this is the outline of my talk. So I'll be starting with an introduction to loop quantum cosmology. So if you forget everything about this talk, at least carry this information with you. And this will tell us the progress till 3 or 4 years ago, and then what were the challenges, what were the questions we were interested in, and then where we needed HPC, where we needed CACTUS, where we needed new algorithms to go forward. For that, we'll have to understand finite difference methods. So this is where I will be focusing on. These have not been covered so far in this school. These are beautiful methods. A lot of theoretical work has been done over the last many decades here. And usually these methods are used by the numerical relativity community to understand what is the best way to discretize a given differential or partial differential equation. Our goal is opposite. We are working with quantum spacetimes. We already have a discretization given to us. We want to understand whether that discretization is consistent and stable. So the goal here is to rule out quantum gravitational approaches. And I will give you examples of what we learn from these methods to rule out loop quantizations. And these, I will show you explicitly how they are ruled out. Then using these methods, once we understand which discretizations are stable, where the instabilities can arise, then we'll discuss how to prove the robustness of quantum bounds. And how can we probe deep Planckian geometry? That is we'll see the bounces which occur very close to the Big Bang. And then I will summarize. So let me start with a very brief introduction to loop quantum cosmology, and let me start with a very simple example of a Big Bang singularity. And I'm going to use just this model throughout my lectures. But the technology which I'm going to present to you can be applied and has been applied to anisotropic spacetimes, to black hole space, black hole interiors, and to massive scalar fields. Things just become more complicated, but they can be done. So let us consider a very simple model, a spatially flat, that means k equal to 0, homogeneous anisotropic universe, FRW universe, sourced with a massless scalar field phi. The matter Hamiltonian is very simple, given by the momentum square of the scalar field divided by the two times, and the v, small v, is the volume of this universe. And you can plug in your favorite formalism. For example, you can do g mu nu equal to t mu nu, or you can do Hamilton's. You can do constraint analysis, and what you find is classically the energy density of the scalar field goes as a to the power minus 6, where a is a scale factor of the universe. And as the scale factor goes to 0, the energy density and the space-time curvature, which means the curvature invariance, they blow up, and there is a singularity in finite time. If you do the Hamilton's equations way, which is the way canonical quantum gravity is also done, we get two solutions, an expanding and a contracting branch. So the idea here is to use phi, the scalar field, as a clock, and to understand how does the scale factor or the volume of the universe changes. So I'm plotting scalar field as a clock versus the volume. And there are two branches, the expanding universe, which starts from the Big Bang and goes towards the expansion, and the contracting universe, which starts from the Big Crunch, which ends in the Big Crunch and then goes in this direction. These two branches are disjoint. They do not talk to each other. And there is no non-singular solution in this theory, classically. So you cannot have any way to resolve this Big Bang singularity. There is a Big Bang and Big Crunch in this singularity. So this is the model we are going to work with. What loop quantum gravity or loop quantum cosmology is going to do is not to touch this part. We don't touch matter in loop quantum gravity. That is an assumption. And we only play with the quantization of the space-time or the quantum gravity part. So there were many attempts. There have been earlier approaches to quantize this simple model. And one of the first attempts goes to Wheeler-DeWitt approach. So let us see what happens in the Wheeler-DeWitt approach. This is a flow chart which we are going to use for loop quantum cosmology also. So it's useful to see that. The idea is to make an assumption that let us just look at the homogeneous modes, which means that we freeze all degrees of freedom except the homogeneous mode in this universe. And we are dealing with a quantum mechanical system rather than a quantum field theoretic system. That's a huge assumption. And the idea is that once we understand the quantum mechanics of this cosmological space-time, probably we can gain some insights on what quantum field theory of this cosmological space-time, quantum cosmological space-time would be, which will be our full quantum gravity. The reason why we want to do this this assumption is because we don't have a full theory of quantum gravity. However, we have enough tools to quantize mechanical systems. We know enough. So the basic idea is that you introduce some phase space. Like the basic variables will be the geometrical phase space, the volume of the universe, and its conjugate momenta, which is proportional to v dot. So this is like the scale factor and the extrinsic curvature in some way. And then the matter, which is a scalar field and its conjugate momenta. Then we just do what we have learned in quantum mechanics for harmonic oscillators. You write down a Hilbert space, kinematical Hilbert space with these operators, which act in this particular way, similarly for the matter part. And since this space-time is hugely symmetric, it is isotropic and homogeneous, there is only one constraint. If you come from the constraint analysis, which is the Hamiltonian constraint, and that Hamiltonian constraint, I'm not worrying about factor ordering right now, takes this particular form, where the gravitational part is v square, pv square part, and then there is a matter part, which is h phi part. So this is the quantum Einstein equation, which you essentially have to solve. So lots of challenges here. It all looks very simple. But if you increase the complexity of the model, constructing physical Hilbert space keeps on becoming more and more complex, because we want these operators to be self-adjoint, essentially self-adjoint, or we should know the self-adjoint extensions and so on. However, all this can be done. And once you do that and plug in everything, then you get a very simple Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which takes this particular form. And then you can ask the question, okay, like if I have all the physical Hilbert space given with me, if I have the observables, then I can do numerics and find the expectation values of how volume changes with phi, and then I can understand how does this picture changes. So that is a goal. So this is a classical picture coming from Einstein's theory. This is what is the quantization, brief summary of quantization of the Wheeler-DeWitt approach. And then the strategy is construct the physical Hilbert space, which means you should have a self-adjoint Hamiltonian constraint operator. You should have an inner product. You should have the physical states, and you should have Dirac observables in the framework. Construct initial states, choose Gaussian states, or choose squeeze states, whatever states you can construct. In the GR epoch, since we don't want to push the problem of boundary conditions, get into the problem of boundary conditions, what we know is we live in a classical universe today. And we are going to choose our initial state now, and we are going to evolve it backwards towards the Big Bang. And then we are going to compare what happens to the expectation values with respect to Einstein's trajectory. So if you do that exercise, what you find is I'm giving a snapshot near the Big Bang. This is a very simple code. One can write even in Mathematica. So you take a state and you evolve it backwards, and that state actually beautifully follows the classical trajectory and keeps following the classical trajectory throughout till the Big Bang. So if you start from the state here in the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, it just goes to the Big Bang. Your code will crash there. Your space-time curvature observable will blow up. Will take very large value, and you know there is a singularity sitting in front. There is no singularity resolution. So the achievement of this approach is that it's non-trivial to even construct such a state and evolve it. And evolve it, the state remains sharply peaked. It doesn't diffuse out. But the problem is that the state just follows the classical trajectory all the way to the Big Bang, and the singularity is not resolved. Now, this is the main problem with the Wheeler-DeWitt approach. Of course, you can solve the singularity problem in Wheeler-DeWitt approach also by an extreme fine-tuning of the energy conditions. If I give you a very arbitrary potential and lots of parameters to play, there will be some solution. You can always do that even in classical cosmology. But the problem is whether that solution is stable, whether it's a generic singularity resolution. That is what we are hunting for in quantum gravity. So that's where loop quantum cosmology becomes very useful. So what is loop quantum cosmology? A very brief introduction. It's a non-perturbative quantization of homogeneous spacetimes using techniques of loop quantum gravity, started by Martin Buyewald in 2001, and then pioneered by Ashrekar and Lewandowski and Buyewald till 2003. It is loop quantum gravity. Very brief introduction is based on connection and triad variables, very much like in electrodynamics, where we have vector potential and the electric field. And these connection and triad variables are symmetry reduced before quantization. And that's one of the assumptions in loop quantum cosmology, that one is doing a huge symmetry reduction even before one can quantize. This approach captures key elements of the underlying discrete quantum geometry, which we have heard a lot in these lectures, when the gravitational part of the Hamiltonian constraint is expressed in terms of holonomies over the closed loops of the symmetry reduced connection. So the gravitational part of the constraint takes this particular form, where n is a lapse, v is the volume of the fiducial cell, which we have to introduce to define the symplectic structure, FAB is the field strength of the connection, and E's are the triads. So E's know about the metric or the scale factor, and F's know about the extrinsic curvature that is now hiding in F, and the metric information is hiding in E. Now, we all know there are a huge number of quantization ambiguities, and these quantization ambiguities also exist in this approach. You can regularize FAB in many, many, many forms. You can take loops in different kind of plackets. And it turns out, a very strong result emerges, that we make a demand that, you can write down many consistent quantizations, and we will come to what do we mean by consistent quantizations, something which is mathematically consistent. But what we demand is that such a quantization must be free of the fiducial structures, first of all, which means that whatever the fiducial cell or a regulator I have used to define the symplectic structure, if I change that regulator, my physics should not change. Secondly, we demand that it should agree with GR in the infrared limit. So this is like convergence of the solutions. Thirdly, we demand that wherever the quantum effects become important, that should be a well-defined scale. I should know quantum effects are going to become important at 1% of the Planck curvature, or 10 to the power minus 6 of the Planck curvature, or whatever. It should not happen that by changing these regulators, my effects keep on changing. And this was a problem in this approach. If you demand all this and you do study various regularizations, it turns out there is a unique regularization which appears, which I will talk about. It is called improved dynamics in literature. And the same conclusion, like when I was doing this, I was following a very different path from more from a what I have learned in cosmology and answering questions like a physicist. But a very different approach was taken by Daniel Carton, Gaurav Khanna, William Nelson, and Mary on understanding von Neumann stability of quantum difference equations. And eventually, coming from two completely orthogonal paths, we reached the same conclusion. And as we will discuss, it will not be surprising that why these two approaches completely agreed to give a unique quantization. Okay, so there is a huge restriction on quantization ambiguities. That is why von Neumann stability is an important thing to learn in these lectures. So let me show you some finite difference equations. So the loop quantization at the level of the physical Hilbert space. So very early works since 2001 were doing loop quantizations, but that was at the kinematical level. Physics was not extracted. What was only known is there is a finite difference equation, and well, it's discrete, so it looks non-singular. But at the level of the physical Hilbert space, where the inner product was known, where the Dirac observables were known, that was done for the first time in 2006. And since then, in the last decade, many generalizations have been done. That equation still takes a very simple form, like a Klein-Gordon equation, where this phi is again the scalar field, and theta, instead of being this del by del v del by del v operator, now is a difference operator, which where c plus c minus c zero and b's, they come from the discrete quantum geometry. I'm not going to go into the details of what these are, of how we come to them. That's a completely different talk. But these all can be done. They have been rigorously derived. And this is a finite difference equation which is uniform stepping in four Planck volumes. So this v is in Planck volumes, unit of Planck volumes, and it's a uniform difference equation in four Planck volumes. So that's a key difference from what we saw in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, where the space was still continuous, the space-time manifold was continuous. Here, the special manifold is discrete. So if you believe that the resolution of singularities is tied to the discreteness of space-time, this is where the hope is. Like, since we have a discrete equation now, and given by quantum geometry, maybe the singularities will be resolved. At small space-time curvature, that is, if you take the large volume limit of this equation, you recover back the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which I showed you earlier. So let us see what happens. So these are very early results of 2006. You start with the same state, what we started in the Wheeler-DeWitt case, and then you evolve that state towards the Big Bang. And what you find is that instead of the Big Bang singularity, that state bounces and latches onto the other trajectory. Remember, like, there were two trajectories, they were disjoint. So you start from one trajectory, and at some point the state latches onto the other trajectory. We were quite surprised with this result. We were hoping that, well, at some point the universe will become just very fuzzy and the whole classical picture will break down. But amazingly, it didn't happen. And we worked on these simulations for 2 years. Like, I was a beginning coder, Tomasz Pawlowski was a beginning coder. We were not very convinced. Ashtekar was not convinced with these results. He was also hoping something else. But for 2 years, we kept on getting the same simulation. And eventually, we got convinced that, well, we have done all kind of convergence tests on our numerics, and this seems to be the right picture. And the same picture emerges in all spacetimes of loop quantum cosmology with some slight differences. So essentially, the idea is that there is a big universe on this side, and if you go backwards, there is another universe on this side, and there is a quantum geometric bridge given by these FABs, which are now non-local, capturing the loop quantum gravity approach. Very surprisingly, what we found, sorry for a typo here, that there is always a maximum energy density at which the bounce happens. The bounce doesn't happen at arbitrary energy densities. There is a rho max, which is achieved by the energy density of the scalar field, which is given by this 0.41 rho Planck, and which is given by this formula where this delta is the minimum area coming from the area operator in loop quantum gravity. And as this delta, and what we also tested is that if you shrink this delta to zero, this energy density keeps on increasing in numerics, and eventually, like, the bounds disappear in the limit. So essentially, if you take the delta going to zero limit, you're taking the limit of quantum discreteness disappearing and Wheeler-DeWitt theory emerging back. One important thing which happened was that this model was then exactly solved. Like, instead of the numerics, with Ashtekar and Alex Kurici, like we found a model which can be exact, which is exactly solvable, and where one can show that bounce occurs for all states in the physical Hilbert space with a maximum of the energy density 0.41. An important thing to remember here is that this bounce is for sharply peaked states. This state is quite sharply peaked at late times. We don't know what happens, or we didn't know what happens for widely spread states. This bounce is occurring at about 1,000 Planck volume from the Big Bang. It's not that the universe is going to the Planck geometric scale. It's at the Planck curvature scale. Remember that if you are trying to collapse a huge dust ball, which is very dense, Planck density can be reached much earlier than you hit Planck volume. It just depends on how much matter you put in. If you have a star made up of gold, it is going to hit Planck density much earlier than it is going to hit the Planck volume. So this large universes, they were capturing space-time, Planckian space-time curvature much before they were hitting actually Planckian geometry. So this is all these is important for when we will do next. So there were lots of open questions. What happens to those states which are very close? What happens to wider states and so on? Now, amazingly, what one can do is that in you can generalize this to many, many kind of space-times, including with potentials, which is analytically very difficult. Remember, we have to remember that this result is not only numerics. You have to know the physical Hilbert space in full detail, even to do any numerics, because you have to construct a wave function from the eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian constraint operator. You cannot just give any arbitrary wave function. It is not going to be, it's not going to do anything.
This value of 0.29, it comes specifically from the spectrum, the discrete spectrum?
If you take J equal to half. If you take the lower spin representation.
So the question is, at this level, if you just make, I mean, it's true that you have this area spectrum and loop quantum gravity, so it's very complicated. But this seems like it's Planck scale area, right? I mean, it's,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a order of magnitude. So anything in which you have put in this cutoff,
it will work.
How much does this framework depend on loop quantum gravity results?
Okay, so that's a very good question. All of the things I'm going to talk about today, my hunch is that it's going to be valid for any consistent theory of quantum gravity which gives you discreteness in geometry. One can show that. You need to do the numerics, you just need to know the physical Hilbert space and the eigenfunctions. That is the technical part where the loop quantum gravity comes and so on. But give me any theory which gives you a discreteness of the geometry. You put in by hand, or you it is derived from more fundamental level, the same result will follow qualitatively. Quantitatively, it may be different, but qualitatively, the similar things will happen. Okay, so now, like this picture which I have shown you, like the one question is like maybe there is a classical trajectory or a effective classical trajectory in an effective space-time which mimics this whole bounce, and the answer turns out to be yes. I'm not going into detail of that, but there is you can actually find an effective space-time which captures all the quantum geometric information. And most of the papers in loop quantum cosmology, which are over 500 now, rich physics has been explored using this effective space-time description. The impact of the bounce has been studied for signatures in cosmological perturbations. There are a couple of talks next week, if you are around, by various people, Aguyo, Ashtekar, Barao, and also Martin. All of us have worked in trying to extract the predictions on cosmological perturbations using this effective space-time. So everyone uses effective space-time. And why effective space-time is valid is an important question numerically. This effective space-time has been also used to look at the modifications to the Rai-Chaudhry equation and then try to devise some sort of a non-singularity results in general for arbitrary matter and so on. And a lot of progress has happened there. And these techniques have been applied to black hole spacetimes, not loop quantum cosmology as per, but all these techniques of whatever we learned as analytical tools, whatever we learned numerically, has been applied to understand black hole interiors and have given some motivation to study gravitational collapse. For example, Planck stars have one motivation coming from these bounces, which Francesca has been studying from last couple of years. Many questions remain open. So this is like towards the end of the summary. The first important question is bounce a generic phenomenon of the theory? I gave you just one example of a massless scalar in spatially flat isotropic homogeneous universe. So I have also told you, like, many space times have been studied, but still, like, most all of these results are numerical results, and maybe there are states which do not lead to such a beautiful picture of a bounce. So we have to understand that. Important question from the physics wise, if we want to understand predictions, is the following. The Shapley peak states, they bounce at volumes greater than about 1000 Planck volume. And for such states, the effective space-time description is excellent. That one can show. And I will also show some results later. But what about those quantum states which probe deep Planck regime? Like, you can always construct states which really go very close to the Big Bang. Now you are hitting the Planck volume scales. And then maybe the effective space-time description turns out to be bad, or at least we haven't tested it there. And if we want to prove non-singularity, some sort of a non-singularity result in general, if we want to extract predictions from the deep Planckian geometric regime, then we have to understand whether effective dynamics still works at very, 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 very scales very, very close to the Big Bang. What is the state of the universe on the other side? Now, that was a big question. A lot of debate happened when I was actually here many years ago with some of my colleagues, and it was really unbelievable that in general we are getting the picture that the state remains sharply peaked, and when it bounces it still remains sharply peaked. That's what we generally expect from quantum mechanics. There have to be dispersions. So what happens? Like, why do these states remain sharply peaked? And is the universe on the other side still classical, or do we get a fuzzy universe on the other side for all the models? And the model I showed you, it turns out it is classical, but what happens in general, and why do we have these sharply peaked states? Eventually, it turns out that if you look at relative fluctuations and Heisenberg uncertainty principle, everything falls into the place. Pavlovsky and Kaminsky in Warsaw have actually proved a theorem that these states will not disperse beyond a point. So, and that is one of the things which we will see. Do bounces occur in quantum anisotropic models? Like, I only showed you isotropic models. What if we have a Bianchi spacetimes, which is, or how do we study BKL scenarios in this framework? What happens to the Schwarzschild interior? Is there a bounce there? What is a black hole to white hole transition? Is there a white hole on the other side? All these questions have to be answered. And analytically, a lot of progress has been made. And very recently, numerically, some progress has started here. And importantly, for isotropic model, there is a, I claimed, and we can prove it if you want, there is a unique consistent quantization which is physically viable. What about anisotropic models and black hole spacetimes? Do we have different quantizations? If we increase the degrees of freedom, does the quantization ambiguity become so complex that now we have different discretizations? And how do we rule out consistent quantizations? So we cannot focus on all the questions in these in the talk today. What I'm going to focus on is this question, which I think is a very beautiful question, and where we will really learn some new numerical methods. And then I will show you, like, based on what we learn here, what we can actually do for these quantum anisotropic models, and also this question. So these are, all these questions are still not fully answered. So there is a slow progress, partial progress, because not only these are analytically very hard questions, because remember, we have to find the full physical Hilbert space. Numerically also, they are very hard questions, and I will convince you why they are numerically very hard questions. So let me come to part two, but if there are any questions for the part one in this introduction, like, I'll be happy to take them right now. Okay, so let me... Sorry?
You asked all the questions.
I asked all the questions, okay. So let us come to part two. So I'm going to change the game now. And I'm just, these are more like the school-oriented part. So finite difference methods we are going to learn. And the key question we have in mind is, given a discretization. So remember, in numerical relativity, people study finite difference methods because they want to solve a PDE very, very efficiently. Our goal is the opposite. We want to understand, suppose my friends write a very beautiful, mathematically consistent quantum gravity theory. How do I know it is viable? Like, so I'm going to use these finite difference methods to understand, given a discretization, how to determine their viability. We'll see that. So let us start with, I'm going to give first a very brief introduction to some of these methods, because you may use them sometime later in life, and also to compare. So consider a PDE, which it depends on time and on x, and with some force term gxt, for example, on this side. Then, depending on the complexity of the underlying geometry, where you want to solve this PDE, and what accuracy you are interested in and what kind of stability you are looking for, there are different methods which are available numerically. There are finite difference methods, there are finite volume methods, there are finite element methods, such as which include these continuous and discontinuous Galerkin methods. I'm going to call this DG because I'm going to use it a little bit in my lectures later on. The finite volume and finite element methods are especially well suited for computations which involve complex geometries. If you have a quantum space-time which is very complex, lots of discontinuities are possible, lots of twists are possible. Then in these complicated domains, these are very useful methods, finite volume and finite element methods. But fortunately, like in loop quantum cosmology, things are much more simpler. And the structure of quantum geometry, as I showed you, only gives you a difference equation. So obviously, we are only going to focus on finite difference method after I tell you a little bit about these. However, for speed up purposes, like these methods are very useful. We should understand that sometimes you may encounter a quantization where you may not have such a beautiful difference equation, and we encountered some of them. And just in the anticipation, we wanted to learn the technology of these methods and apply them to our techniques and to see how much these methods help in speed up. Then we also developed some algorithm which uses this discontinuous Galerkin method. So I'll mention it briefly. These are not necessary, but these are good tools to have for loop quantum cosmology to speed up your calculations a bit more. So let me come to something very, very briefly, which we are not going to focus on. So I'll go very fast here. So the finite volume methods. In these finite volume methods, the solution of this PDE is approximated in a small volume around a node, which you can find. And then by a constant, and you essentially solve this equation, which turns out to be a finite volume analog of a finite difference equation. It's a very useful method if you have a non-linear situations, and then you can do very nice computations of fluxes using the divergence theorem. And it can really do lots of things if you are working at the linear or slightly nonlinear order to get a very consistent answer. An improvement of this method, because one of the weaknesses of this method is computation of fluxes in higher, if you're looking at higher accuracies, is what is called as continuous Galerkin method, which is somewhat closer to what we do already in loop quantum gravity, essentially because it's based on using distributions. And in this continuous Galerkin scheme, the idea is to use a base to introduce these elements where the local solution is approximated using these basis functions ends. And using these basis functions, instead of solving that partial differential equation in this way using the averages or in the conventional finite difference way, you essentially look at a global integral, and these are just like your test functions, and you solve this equation, which is essentially called as a weak formulation. And once you solve this equation, then you will get a finite element solution, one of the ways to get the finite element solution. A difficulty with this method is that once this equation is a global, you are looking at a globally continuous solution, there is an inversion of a global matrix involved, which also makes a method time implicit. So if you're looking at time evolution, this is not a very useful method, still quite useful otherwise. And a variant of this method is a discontinuous Galerkin method, in which the idea is that with each element, so this is like a continuous Galerkin method where you have different elements, you have a solution given by this red line, reddish, brownish red line, and this is the actual function you're approximating with this linear piecewise approximation in each element, but demanding the continuity at each node so that globally everything is continuous. In the discontinuous Galerkin methods, you do not demand continuity at each node. And what happens is that you get a very similar equation like this, but which is now a local integral. And then you can use the divergence theorem from the finite volume methods to compute the fluxes, match the fluxes, and get a nice solution. So this discontinuous Galerkin method is actually a hybrid of the finite volume method and the continuous Galerkin method. This is just for some introduction if you encounter these words later on. One advantage of this method is that this is an explicit time scheme, so it is very useful for studying time evolution problems. And the operators are more sparse, still far more accurate, but more sparse, which causes a speed up of your computation. So this is a good method to use if you want a speed up. But now let me come to finite differences. So I'm going to go slow on this because there may be very young students here. So and then we will use these methods to understand various things. The finite difference method, the basic idea is start from this definition of the derivative, and then you can do differences in various ways. Essentially, you introduce a grid with some spacing h. You can do a forward difference, which means do x plus h minus x. You can do a backward difference, x minus f of x minus h. Or you can do a central difference between f of x plus h and f of x minus h. So this is a simple difference, simplest way we can introduce differences. Central differences, this is what I'm doing, is just a linear approximation everywhere between the points. And the central difference gives more accurate approximation if h satisfies this. Similarly, you can do you can write various difference formulas, and you can see when is some method more accurate than the other. And essentially the idea is that depending on how these functions behave and what discreteness you have chosen, one method will be more accurate than the other. So that is the basic biology of finite difference methods. Okay, so now let us solve the same partial differential equation I was trying to solve using finite volume methods. So choose a spatial grid labeled by xk with k going from 1 to n, and at a grid point x, the PDE is approximated using central difference as this formula. Why use central difference? No particular reason except that it is more accurate, because here I was using linear approximation to write the difference formula. The goal is that if you start with forward or backward difference and go to quadratic approximation, you get the central difference. So central difference is slightly more advanced. Okay, so this is just for illustration. I'm not changing anything about time. This is a semi-discrete scheme. This is continuous, just step by step. This is discretized. And then these W and F, W are numerical approximations to V and F I had in PDEs. And these are assumed to be well approximated by local polynomials. So this is a general algorithm for finite differences. You can do semi-discrete. You can keep one as continuous, you can discretize the other one, and you can do central difference, forward difference, various ways. We will do some of the different ways. The benefit of this method is very simple. It's highly efficient. It is explicit in time. There is a huge amount of theoretical understanding of this method. Like, there are theorems which are proved, which you can easily use in your numerics. But it is unsuitable for complex geometries and discontinuities, but fortunately we don't encounter them in at least in loop quantum cosmology so far. Now let me go to more details of finite difference methods, but now I'll focus completely on hyperbolic equations, which is what we are interested in. So let us consider this hyperbolic PDE, which is given in this particular form, where alpha is some constant. I'm just taking one PDE so far. So we want to do initial value problem. So you give a initial data at some t equal to 0, and then the idea is use this PDE to find the u at positive values of time. It's a very simple PDE with a solution which is given by this xi u naught of xi with xi as x minus alpha t. And this solution defines for us characteristics of this equation, of this PDE. Characteristics are lines on which this solution, this xi, is constant. And you can think of, like, these are essentially like the plane waves, where the alpha will be the speed of the propagation along this characteristic, speed of propagation of these solutions along the characteristics. This speed is going to be very important for us because it plays a very important role in stability. The main idea is that given this PDE, you can find the characteristics and you can find the speed. If you're given a system of hyperbolic equations where now these u's are vectors, the characteristic speeds, they are now not one characteristic speed, but can be more characteristic speeds, which are given by the eigenvalues of this matrix alpha. This matrix alpha is diagonalizable and has real eigenvalues because this equation, set of equations, is hyperbolic. Simple thing so far. Now, how do we do different finite differencing? Now, I'm going to do finite differencing for both, for t and x, because we have a full quantum space-time. That's what we are aiming for. So you discretize, this is x and this is t, and you discretize, here I've taken same size of h and k, but it's not important. So this is the discreteness in x, and this is k is a discreteness in time. So we introduce grids in both time and space coordinates, and any point tn xm is represented as nk and mh, where n and m are integers. And since we have different methods to do derivatives, forward difference, backward difference, central difference, and so on, we have different ways to discretize any partial differential equation. So just two examples. So it is called as forward time, forward space, which means use the, for the derivative in time, use a forward differencing. For a derivative in space, use forward spacing, forward differencing. This is a one-step method of the same PDE, which I showed you here. That one-step method gives you this finite differencing equation. You only need one value to find the solution at all times. Then there is something called as leapfrog method. There are various, this is a multi-step method. Instead, this is a one-step method. It goes in one step in M and one step in N. The leapfrog method goes in multi-steps because it has M plus 1 and also M minus 1 sitting here. And you need at least two values to compute the solution everywhere. Similarly, there are different methods. And people who do numerical relativity, they make a choice. They say, okay, like this method looks more useful now to solve this particular PDE, which I want to solve in classical numerical relativity, and I know what the errors are in this method, and then or they develop new methods in their research.
Can you explain the motivation for the method?
There is no real motivation for this talk. Just an example. We will come to the motivation. We will come to some of it because it turns out that many of these methods will be unstable and some of these methods are stable. But as far as LQC is concerned, there is no specific motivation. I'm just giving examples. So stability is one thing which will decide which method to choose, and then the speed, which what, how?
Just that I don't see what these two equations, how they can be doing similar things.
Well, these both are the same, these are two different discretizations of this equation.
Yeah, okay, can you show this leapfrog? It doesn't matter if you take, because the first term seems to do both a space derivative and a time derivative.
Yes. Okay, so now let us come to, let us take forward Bianca's question and which method to choose? Which method to choose? So what is important here to understand is the consistency and convergence. These are two different things. So I'm going to just take one example, which is of the using this forward time, forward space discretization right now. And using this discretization, if we take our partial differential equation we are considering, then the difference equation turns out to be this simple equation. And I'm defining a lambda, which is the inverse of the characteristic speed, which is the ratio of the discreteness in time and the discreteness in space, k by h. Now, the comparison between the solution from the finite differencing, which is here, and the PDE then depends on lambda and h. Depending on what lambda and h you choose, what discreteness you choose in space and time, your solution may be approximating the PDE much, much, much better or not so good. Now, there are two different things. One is a consistency. The consistency means that a smooth solution of a partial differential equation is also a solution of the corresponding finite difference equation, which means that you start with a partial differential equation, I give you a solution, then you can always find a smooth solution of the finite difference equation which approximates it. The convergence means that whether all the solutions of the finite difference scheme approximate solutions of the corresponding PDE, it's a much more stronger requirement that whatever is a solution of your finite difference scheme has to fit this PDE. So a finite difference scheme may be consistent, but it may not be convergent at all. And that is a key point for the viability of discretization. We may be able to write a mathematically consistent theory of quantum gravity, but unless we show that all of its solutions, which are physical, which we think are physical, which lie in the physical Hilbert space, are not converging to any continuous theory, when we take these discreteness parameters to zero, then we may have an issue in our theory. Or we should be able to rule out such solutions. Maybe like it can happen that those solutions are there only at the kinematical level in the Hilbert space, but when you take the inner product, those solutions disappear. So there is a very important theorem in finite difference techniques, which says that a consistent finite difference scheme for which initial value problem is well posed is convergent if and only if it is stable. So that is why we have to understand when finite difference schemes are stable. If you can have finite difference scheme which is stable and consistent, then we are fine. Then we have satisfied all the criteria, and then such a discretization will be a good discretization. So let me come to the stability now. What do we mean by stability? The stability leads to restrictions on H and K, and this is given by Korn-Frederick's-Levy condition, that for a hyperbolic equation like this, with an explicit finite time differencing, which is of this particular form, with a lambda which is fixed, which means the inverse of the characteristic speed, a necessary condition for stability is that alpha lambda, the modulus of alpha lambda, is less than equal to 1. It is bounded by 1, and we will see like how it comes about. The main idea, physical idea, is that the numerical speed of the propagation must be greater than the speed of propagation of the PDE. Otherwise, you will not have all the data in your cone. This speed is also, this scheme is also captured by what is called as Courant number many times, which is just defined as alpha times lambda. And numerically, sometimes people don't look at the CFL condition, but they just look at the Courant number and say, well, Courant number is bounded by 1, so I'm happy. Okay, let us take... Okay, I can take a break for some time. Okay.